I'm not going to talk about my weekend. It was very strange.
Did it involve a roast beef dinner that was very good?
It involved a roast chicken dinner.
Was it very good?
It was very good.
Was there stuffing?
Rather than talk about roast dinner, should we get on with this?
Cauliflower, broccoli and carrots. I would really like a roast beef dinner right now.
The CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Guevara, Kraftwerk and Ellie Goulding. It's the CMU podcast, the week in music that we're going to talk about. Nah, next week. Next week's the week that I will think of a tagline for this podcast.
So you didn't use your bank holiday weekend to come up with the perfect strapline?
No, other things happened.
Are you going to use this weekend?
No, it's my sister's wedding.
Oh, weddings. They're long. I do. When's dinner? Speeches. Plenty of opportunities to just take a few moments to yourself and come up with the perfect strapline.
Maybe...
I'm not saying your sister's wedding's going to be boring or anything, but weddings in general, they're quite long and there's lots of bits in the day where you've got nothing to do.
Being a family member, I will have to meet a lot of people. So my icebreaker with them might be, what tagline would you give a weekly music industry podcast?
Or if you find yourself in a conversation that's boring you...
We could ask the listeners, but...
Perfect get out.
I'm not sure they're up to it.
No, I think you're...
So I think wedding guests who have no connection to the music... Actually, some of them will have connection to the music industry, but that's beside the point.
It's beside the point. We don't want to know about your rock and roll relatives. I think you
none
should,
of my relatives are rock and roll.
You should find the oldest relation in the room.
I was the first one in my family to go into rock and roll.
Were you? That's where it all went wrong. Prior to that, people got proper jobs. So you need to find the oldest relative in the room and ask them for the strapline. And that's the strapline we'll have on next week's
podcast. I think she'll
be
good. I tried to explain the podcast to my grandmother once.
So I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to next week's podcast so much that I'm sort of now already feeling a bit despondent about this podcast. Because I think next week is going to be
all right, well,
the
let's
edition.
Let's just scoot through it as quickly as
this
possible.
This is a Wednesday edition.
It is. It's a disclaimer. If you're listening to this on Friday or later and you're wondering why we missed the big story of the week that happened on Thursday, it's because we're recording on Wednesday.
And that's your fault this week.
No, it's my sister's fault.
It's
getting
your
married.
Sister's fault. Forget it clearly. So we're recording this on Wednesday. So that massive thing that happens tomorrow, yesterday, last Thursday, we're not going to talk about. But now I come to think about it, it wasn't really that massive.
It was not really a story.
It wasn't.
No.
I don't even know why people talked about it.
No.
Let's...
So just forget about that and we'll tell you about the things that really matter.
Now, because this is a Wednesday edition, we're recording it in the evening, which means that all of the other people who work in the building where the little studio is where we record this have now gone home. So we could have a party outside.
I can see someone.
Oh, there's someone there. We can't have a party. I was gonna suggest.
I can see two, three, oh, someone just four people.
They work very hard here.
And Matt's here.
Matt's here. But we could
and
lock
he,
Matt.
Matt works here.
We could lock so Matt in the control room.
We could, but he'd still be here.
And then we could have a party in the building because it is a late edition. So if we're sounding a bit more relaxed, if it's a bit more late night radio, we might, you know, do some, I don't know, love song dedications later because we're recording this
we might do.
Later in the day. But before the podcast, I was teaching, you know, I was doing a job, earning some money for the old company. You were having a little meeting this afternoon, which was sort of a continuation from what we talked about last week. That related to what we talked about at CMU Insights at the Great Escape 2016 in Brighton last month?
Yeah. I've just literally come here just now from a meeting with an organisation called Mental Health First Aid.
Which, with hindsight, you probably should have met before the Great Escape and then we could have involved them in the programme.
Could have done, but there's always next year.
There is always next year. Don't use everything up in edition number one.
Actually, my hope is that they will go and involve themselves in the music industry. I'm going to help them. Find their way in.
So this related to the afternoon as part of our conference at the Great Escape where we looked at mental health in the music community, which is suddenly a big talking point, and that's a good thing, and we helped really kickstart that debate. So obviously there is Help Musicians Survey that we mentioned. There's the Music Supports Helpline Initiative, which I can't even remember if we talked about last week.
I think we did.
We definitely talked about it at the Great Escape, and maybe we'll probably, because obviously we're doing the reports on the Great Escape. We're drip feeding them throughout June.
Yes.
So if you weren't at the Great Escape, then there are reports coming up in the CMU Daily each day. They started at the start of this week and they'll be throughout the rest of the month. So I think at some point there'll be a little report on music supports and what it does. So if you miss that, then that is coming up. So there are various initiatives underway. The Music Managers Forum are looking into this. They had an article in The Guardian last month, I think, on this topic. And so you're hoping that you can link up a few different organisations and really take it. We talked about last week, didn't we? That we had a really good conversation at the Great Escape. But the real challenge now is not for everyone to go home wasn't it good of us to have that conversation at the press gate? We fix that now and move on to the next thing.
No, we want to keep the conversation moving, and here we are. This is keeping the conversation moving. So if you work for a music company, which is likely, if you're listening to this, I would say, then you should check out an organisation called Mental Health First Aid, who, that's what they do. They do mental health first aid training to help you spot when someone might be having a mental health problem and how to get support for them. And they're really, like, I've not been on one of their courses, but they're very well regarded courses and would be a great kind of starting point for just ensuring that your staff are all fine, which as an employer is your responsibility. So
are you pointing at me as an employer there?
I wasn't, but I could be.
Your employer.
Yeah. It's your responsibility to make sure I'm all right, but
weirdly,
in a wider
you're the
sense,
one who's going to go on the course, not me.
Yeah, and then I have to check if you're all right, but yeah, that's not my responsibility.
Not your responsibility.
Just do it out of niceness.
As co-host,
yeah,
there may not be an employer-employee relationship, but there's a co-host relationship.
But yeah, people should be looked after, and this is a great starting point for doing that, so go and check out that organisation.
And we'll be reporting on them later in the year, is
we
the plan.
We will, yes.
That's the plan. Mm. So watch this space for more. Plus, as we say, we are reporting on the key sessions from CMU Insights at The Great Escape 2016 in the CMU Daily throughout June. And there's already some of the interviews that I did on the last day. They're on the site. And will be more of that, including coverage of the various mental health conversations that took place at The Great Escape, still to come. So that is something that we did and we're going to do.
Yes.
Now it's time for this podcast. Looking back at the week in music.
Well, we said we were going to bring you the big stories, and here they come. Streaming
is a thing.
Is a thing.
Breaking news, everybody.
Yep. Wait, I haven't finished.
People are streaming music.
I have not finished. Streaming is a thing, and it faces challenges. That's the big news this week, and that's what we're going to talk about now.
Now, you may remember that last week, in amongst everything, in the bit, do we call, you know, when we do the, this is what we didn't have time to talk about, bit,
yeah,
towards the end of the podcast,
yeah,
which is coming up, ladies and gentlemen. Do we call that one-liners, or do we just call that one-liners internally?
No, it's called what we didn't have time to talk about.
Because obviously, in the CMU Daily, we have the one-liners, which is basically news in brief. I don't know why I'm discussing.
Yeah, but I think in audio, if we called that one-liners in audio form, people might think that there was a section of the podcast where we told jokes.
And they would be
there is no humour in this podcast.
Indeed. But my point is that in that bit last week, we mentioned that in the week preceding that podcast, while we were away for The Great Escape and Canadian Music Week, Spotify's financials for 2015 were published. There was some good news in there in that they've seen huge growth. We already knew that. We knew their user numbers were growing and growing and growing. We had some financials thrown into that as well. So their revenues were up. Their ad revenues had nearly doubled. I mean, advertising is still a tiny part of what they do. But
really tiny part.
A really tiny
part. Like 2%.
But it was twice as big as it had been the previous year in terms of revenue. And then I think the subscription revenues were up something like 80%. Massive growth. But, aha, massive growth when it comes to losses as well. So Spotify is still a loss-making company.
Well, not massive growth, but...
Well, not massive growth in losses, but still losses, and they were up.
Losses that were up, like fairly well-sustained losses.
So the losses are still significant, and they were higher in 2015 than they were in 2014.
Yes.
Despite the booming revenues and the booming user numbers. And obviously Spotify now almost certainly is in the run-up to IPO. They will float probably on one of the New York stock exchanges probably next year.
Yeah, one day we'll stop saying
probably.
That.
At one point they'll stop denying that IPO is on the agenda, and they'll finally tell us when that's happening. And so in their financials, obviously currently a private company, but a lot of investors now, and it was like, oh, this is all fine. It's all fine. Look at the growth. We're a scale business. Once we reach a certain size, it'll all be fine, and we'll start to go into profit, and we'll make all the money back. Probably the other side of an IPO. Certainly the other side of an IPO. So that was the message in the Spotify financials, and it kickstarted a debate about whether or not it is all going to be fine. Okay, yes, you're a scale business, but quite how much scale?
Yeah, what is that scale, and is it achievable?
So how many, given they make all their money on premium subscriptions, how many premium users do you need to go into profit? And are there that many potential premium subscribers in the world? So since the Spotify financials, there have been some other bits of news coming in. So first of all, Pandora. Now, their financials came out a while back, their most recent quarterly figures. But the story on Pandora in the last couple of weeks, well, one of their shareholders who has something, what, 9%?
Just under 10%. It's actually, their biggest shareholder.
So the single biggest shareholder, which is a hedge fund.
Yeah, called Corvex Management.
Who I think have really rapidly increased their shareholding recently. But anyway, they put out a statement. Well, they sent a letter to the chairman of Pandora, which they then published for us all to see, in which they said, we were surprised to see Brian McAndrews, the former CEO of Pandora, leave somewhat out of the blue, which is what did happen a few months back. We were surprised to see Tim Westergren, the co-founder of Pandora, return to the CEO role after all these years. And we're a bit disappointed that Tim seems to think it's business as usual. We're carrying on when we, as your single biggest shareholder, think now is time to sell.
Yes.
Let us cash in our shares.
I said they're currently following a costly and uncertain business plan. And yes, Corvex thinks that a more certain business plan would be to get shot of this sinking ship.
Of course, that wouldn't be a business plan for the business.
They didn't say sinking ship, I should add. That was my
That influence. Was your editorialising.
Yeah, there. Yeah.
So selling it would be a plan for current investors because they get a quick payday. It's not really a plan for the company because whoever bought it would have to turn Pandora into a profitable company. So Pandora's been going a long time.
It has. And in terms of streaming services, it's doing very well on some measures.
Users.
It's got a lot of users. It made almost $300 million in the last quarter, but it is still a loss-making company.
And it's been going a lot longer than everybody else. So it's hard for Pandora to say, oh, we're in the early stages of growth. It's like, well, you've been in the early stages of growth for a very long time now. I mean, last count, it was about 80 million active users. I think it's now higher than that, which basically means that Pandora, which only really exists in the US, they are also in Australia and New Zealand, but really they're just... They're a US service. That's where the vast, vast majority of their users are. So in one market, they are almost as big as Spotify is, being in, what, 60-odd markets now. So they're only in one country, and yet they are massive. Probably the second biggest in terms of users. Well, that's assuming we're not counting YouTube and SoundCloud. That's another story for another day. But they're a massive company. They are bringing in sizable revenues, but they're still loss-making. And Pandora is almost exclusively advertising funded. They do have a paid for option, unlike their main competitor in the US, iHeartRadio, which is all ad funded. You can pay Pandora $5 a month to get rid of the ads, unlimited skips, because of course Pandora is a personalized radio service rather than a Spotify type service. So you can't go in and pick an album or create your own playlist. You tell it what sort of music you like, and then it plays a constant personalized stream. And you can skip tracks on the free service. You can only skip a certain number of tracks. I don't know if it's an hour per day. I'm not American. I can't use this bloody service. But you have a certain number of skips. You pay them $5 a month. Get rid of the advertising. You can have unlimited skips. Although hardly anybody does that. I mean, they're a bit vague on how many of their 80 million users are paying. But most estimates are it's no more than 5%.
Yeah.
So 95% are on the free version, which then means they need to sell an awful lot of advertising because they are licensed under the Sound Exchange license, which is an American compulsory license, which means the record companies have to play ball. And then the music publishers license through the collective licensing system. So there's an upside to that, which is the labels and the publishers can't say no to Pandora because of the way American copyright works. So that's great. Having said that, on Sound Exchange, they're paying a minimum rate per stream. So it means it's great having those 80 million users, but that means more streams. The rates are all set in the Sound Exchange license by the Copyright Royalty Board. So they have big payments to make to the labels. Advertising ain't paying for it. And of course, what we've seen from Pandora in the last year, under both the previous CEO and now with Tim Westergren back in charge, is what they're saying is, don't worry about the fact we're not selling enough advertising. We're going to find other ways of making money. Okay, so they're not saying we just need to sell some more ads. We'll do a better job of that. We'll get a bigger sales team. We'll do a bit of local advertising. That's how radio stations make money.
No, they're like, we'll build an on-demand service that we can then launch in other territories.
And which
they've actually said that, but that's basically what they're planning to do.
And they can charge $10 rather than $5 for that.
And they've bought a ticketing company, and then they're like, well, we can integrate ticketing into this, and then that's an upsell, and it'll all be great.
And we'll have multiple revenue streams, and it'll be brilliant. Of course, the downside of that is, well, let's have a look at those other revenue streams. If you're saying you're never going to make enough for advertising alone, okay, on demand, you can go into other countries because you're no longer reliant on that American compulsory license. So you go and do direct deals with the labels. Okay, you can charge more for on demand because the going rate is $10 rather than $5. Having said that, every on-demand streaming service in the world is losing money. So it's not an easy way of making money.
It's not something you can go, look at this, this is a great thing that will make our business better.
And however good that radio technology you bought last year may be, you're still going to be in a very competitive and in the main loss-making market. Ticketing, there is more of a logic to that. You're sitting on all that data. You've got the direct-to-fan relationship. You know what music people like. You know where they live. Why not sell them tickets? The problem there is, although they bought in a ticketing company and therefore have the right to sell tickets for certain shows, ticketing is so dominated, well, in the US by Live Nation and Ticketmaster, basically. you're going up against a company that has such control of the market. Ask all the ticketing startups. It's really hard beyond grassroots gigs.
Although they have, it would be in conjunction with that. So they've got, I can't remember what it's called, but they've got that new service that they're testing at the moment where artists can record audio ads and pump them into people's feeds and they can target them. So you could say, hey, I've seen you've been listening to our songs. We're coming to your town soon. Why not buy a ticket? Here's a link.
The challenge there, though, is artists and management, and even label maybe, may think that's a great idea. They don't necessarily control the tickets. The promoter and their ticketing agent control the tickets. So then you're in a thing, what if the promoter doesn't want to sell tickets via Pandora's ticketing company, or they have an exclusive deal with a Ticketmaster or whoever? Can you then do a deal with Ticketmaster where you are still cut into the committee? It's not as simple as perhaps Pandora have been suggesting. Nevertheless...
Or perhaps thought when they bought Ticketfly.
Perhaps they thought. So that's Pandora's solution. We're going to have lots of different revenue streams. But I suppose the big development this week in all of this, because Pandora's figures came out a while ago, that letter came out a couple of weeks ago. Since then, we've got yet more, oh, Pandora's going to be sold speculation. People have been speculating about that. All the companies that they say, oh, they'll probably buy it, almost certainly have no interest in buying a massively loss-making company, even with all of the extra revenue streams they're building. But Spotify was 10 days ago. Pandora has been in and out of the news for a few weeks now. The new bit of this, which is what you build at the start of the podcast, is Gavera, the Australian ad-funded streaming service, have confirmed that they are now building up to IPO, and a whole load of documentation has come out ahead of that.
Yeah, Gavera, which I guess is a company that people would know in the UK mainly for its purchase and subsequent shutting down of Blinkbox without relaunching it.
Yeah, Gavera had plans to launch in the UK, bought the Tesco streaming service Blinkbox for reasons we never quite understood to enter the UK market. But before they actually did anything with that, they shut it down and fired everybody.
Yeah, and are now mainly in the news in the UK because former Blinkbox employees are suing them for £10 million.
Because the agreement between Gavera and Tesco when they bought Blinkbox was there would be protection for those employees that then wasn't done. Yeah, so that's been rumbling through the courts for about a year now.
And we'll come back to that in a second.
Why not?
But let's talk about this IPO. So yeah, Gavera is trying to raise between 40 and 80 million Australian dollars. They'd be willing to go up to 100 if people wanted to put in more. You know, if they were forced to go to 100, they would consider doing it.
If there were people queuing at the door saying, please let us invest in your stream service.
So they're selling shares for a dollar each, which is quite reasonable, and they want to sell at least 40 million. They'd prefer 80 million. And, you know, if they really had to, they would be willing to sell 100 million shares. And they want that money so that they can repay creditors and debts and pay for sales expansion activities in a number of markets, which all sounds like surely that's a thing going like, hey, invest in our company. We got some debts we need paying off. It's not the sexiest of propositions, but there are other things.
Well, there was expansion there. You mean you focused in on the negative.
I focused on the
negative. What about all this exciting expansion they're talking about?
And the expansion is very exciting because this is a company with figures and they have released the figures. And they have released the figures that state in their 2015 financial year, they made 1.2 million Australian dollars.
In revenue.
In revenue. They did lose 81 million Australian dollars, which, I mean, you could see that as a bit of an imbalance. But they've made 1.2 million Australian dollars in the first half of this year alone.
So, look at that, 2016's going well.
They have lost $55.7 million in the first half of this year. But you still might want to invest in them.
So, Gavera are following the pattern of all streaming services of being loss-making, although that is incredibly significantly loss-making.
I mean, that's... But, right, there's some things they brought up. So they brought up the Blinkbox thing, and they said, we know you might, as an investor... be a little bit worried. If you're not worried about our financial revenue versus loss figures, you might be a little bit worried about this lawsuit that's hanging over us in the UK being sued for £10 million. Don't worry, we will definitely win that. That's basically what they said.
That's all good.
Investor proposal. They also added the Omniphone, which went out of business, I think, while we were on a break with the podcast.
It was.
On the break that we've just been on, not our break. It happened recently, is what I'm trying to say.
So Omniphone were one of those white label digital music companies who powered other people's download stores and streaming stores.
And powered Gavera's streaming stores in some markets.
They went into administration.
Yes, and Gavera says, when Omniphone went into administration, they immediately stopped providing content. And I think they were using them in like 40 territories or something.
So suddenly, button was switched, no music streaming.
And so the administrators have come in and they have now said to Guevara, hey, you owe us money. And Guevara are saying, well, no, because you stopped providing us with content and therefore you breached your contract and we owe you nothing.
So in some ways...
And so that's the other thing. And again, you might be concerned that we owe money to Omnifo. We don't. And we're very confident that we will not have to hand over any money. So that's like, that's a lot of money we're saving there. We're not going to lose this lawsuit and we're not going to have to pay one of our suppliers. So that is a good reason to invest.
I suppose, therefore, that's Guevara. The upside of their service suddenly stopping in all of those territories when Omnifone went under is, well, assuming that they win that battle with the Omnifone administrator, all the money they owed Omnifone, they're no longer going to have to pay.
Would you like a sense that you're maybe not convinced?
I think I'm doing a good job of sounding convinced compared to the job you're doing of selling this company as an investment opportunity.
All right, well, I can sense that you're on the verge of investing in Guevara. Would you like an uplifting and helpful quote from their chairman?
Give it me.
To just tip you over the edge into like, here's 40 million Australian dollars.
Let's remember he's Australian, so presumably you're
going to
do this in
an
Australian accent.
I am not going to do the Australian accent. His name is Phil Quartararo, which is his name. And he says, primarily focused on mobile digital advertising, today's Guevara revenue model replicates that of a major social media company. So that's very reassuring.
Not making any money.
You will... he's probably thinking Facebook, but I think...
Yeah, but Facebook make money, so that doesn't work.
I'm thinking Twitter.
You're thinking Twitter. So, Guevara has actually been around for a very long time. Their proposed arrival in the UK that didn't happen was relatively recent. But Guevara first sort of came about before really streaming was taking off. Originally, they were a download service, an ad-funded download service. There were various attempts
at
that.
Which is what Blinkbot was.
Yes,
back
Blinkbot
when it was Wii 7. It was,
perhaps that's what drew them to Blinkbot.
Yeah.
They had the shared rubbish business model at the outset. And so they were going to say, oh, we'll have a web page and it'll be branded and it'll be sponsored. And then you go and watch an ad and then you can download a track. And that was the original business model. I think they launched it in Australia and a couple of other territories, including the US, I think. And then they sort of disappeared. They were still operating in those territories, but they're certainly over here.
You just didn't hear of them.
We didn't hear of them. And then suddenly they came back as a streaming service and predominantly an ad-funded streaming service. And I think the exact service varies from market to market. In some markets, they are predominantly a personalised radio service, so like Pandora. In others, they're offering services more like Spotify. But they're very much on the ad-funded model. And the boss of Guevara, this is a couple of years back when they seemed to be growing. Certainly, they were launching in lots of new territories. And he made a very big deal about how services like Spotify and Deezer, who originally had the free ad-funded levels, and certainly Spotify in the early days implied that they were going to have two businesses, ad-funded, free over here, premium over here. And then most of those services started to say, oh no, free is just an upsell platform. We'll sell a bit of advertising to reduce our losses, but we're not really in the ad-funded business. We just have freemium so we can upsell premium. Where he was saying, oh, you've given up on ad-funded too soon. Actually, there's a really good business to be done there. You just didn't sell it right to the brands. And we've got some different ways of doing it.
What this investor proposal says. It very much talks up. We are in a prime position to take advantage of the online advertising boom.
And all the other streaming players, with perhaps the exception of Pandora and iHeart in the US, they're not capitalising on this. They're seeing advertising very much as a secondary revenue stream. We've cracked it. We've got better products. We sell it better. We're doing more sponsored content, although actually Spotify have started doing sponsored playlists this week too.
Thing this week.
But so we've got the ad market sorted, so it's going to work. Huge opportunity. Although, clearly by those figures you were quoting earlier, we all know it's really hard to make any money out of streaming. It's really hard to make any money out of ad-funded streaming.
And
I think Guevara's figures would confirm
that. As much as Guevara are saying, we are on top of this, we know what we're doing, we can really sell that advertising and make that money, they're not at the moment.
And I think all content providers who are trying to do free services online, ad-funded, from newspapers to magazines to radio stations to TV stations through to sort of streaming music services. The big challenge is, yes, there has been a massive boom in internet advertising over the last 10 years, and that continues to grow. But so much of that money goes to Google and predominantly to Google Search and Google Mail, less so to their content services, a bit to YouTube. A lot of it goes to Facebook, and a lot of it goes to the other sort of search engine email providers. And they all sell dirt cheap advertising, because once you've built a search engine, it's not that expensive to run. Once you've built a social network, it's not that expensive to run. Whereas if you are a content company, where either you're having to create content every day of the week, you know, like what CMU does. It's hard work, you know, or all those terrible Bieber gags. You know, they're hard work producing all of that stuff.
I just pluck it out. I do pluck it out. Yeah.
You do pluck that out. But some of the stuff we do is hard work. Or if you're like a Spotify Guevara, you're not necessarily creating so much content, but you're buying all that content in, and that's really expensive. So when you're a content-driven service, rather than an email or search or social network service, you have all of these costs, but the Googles and Facebooks of this world keep the prices down low. And it's really hard to make any money. And newspapers are suffering, magazines are suffering, TV and radio as they move online. There may be subscription services there, but ad-funded is really hard. And that, I think, is why Spotify, in the main, have sort of sidelined the advertising business and made that secondary. And actually, we're in the business of premium, but we have the freemium service to upsell. Pandora in the US basically said, we can't make this work on advertising alone. We have to find a subscription model. We have to move into ticketing and direct-to-fan. That's how we're going to make money. And yet you've still got Guevara saying, no, advertising's the future. And perhaps they have got some massive, exciting, innovative secret that no one else has thought of how they're going to make money. But if they have, they've not got it out of the box yet.
No, they've just got some debts they need to pay off and they need some help with it.
So it's a tricky times for Guevara, tricky times for Pandora, and even Spotify, despite those, you know, I mean, Spotify's revenues are massive. And they're growing hugely, but they're still ultimately making a loss. Which brings us back to sort of where we started, which is, well, where next for streaming? Because remember, we've talked about this before on the podcast, when you look at the record industry's figures, whether those are the BPI figures in the UK or the IFPI figures worldwide, or when you look at the quarterly reports from Sony and Universal and Warner, streaming is becoming the biggest revenue stream. And you're starting to see the majors now saying streaming's outperforming downloads. More than that, streaming's outperforming everything. So streaming is now bigger than CD sales or all the other revenue streams. And the indies are all sitting on the side saying, yeah, it's been like that for us for years now. Streaming is the single biggest revenue stream. And in the short term, that's great because all these loss-making streaming services, they've all agreed to minimum guarantees. So though in theory, they're on a revenue share deal, so the industry gets a share of the revenue, but it's revenue share with minimum guarantees on top. So the labels, the publishers are guaranteed a certain amount of money per stream, per user, every month, every year. And that money is good money. But it's money coming in from loss-making companies. And eventually that has to stop. The venture capital, the money they're now borrowing, the money they're getting in from telcos on bundle deals, from the big tech companies who bundle in. At the end, all of that's going to run out. And will there be a viable, profitable streaming business at the end of this, predominantly funded by subscriptions with maybe a bit of advertising money on the end, which means the services can make a profit and the record companies and the publishers continue to see the levels of money they're already seeing? And actually, really, given downloads are now tanking and CDs are still in slow decline, the music industry needs streaming to continue to grow rapidly just to stay level.
Yeah.
If the record industry thinks it's ever going to get back to that CD peak of the late 90s, the early 2000s, I mean, they probably aren't. But if they want to get closer to the peak of the CD boom, then they need streaming to still grow massively. And that poses the big question. Streaming is booming. The labels and publishers are making lots of money. That's great. But how much scale? And that's what we come back to. How much scale does Spotify need? How much scale does the market need of paying users? Let's assume, even if there is 3, 4, 5 times as much advertising money as we're currently getting to be got, if just we can get the advertising product right, that's still not enough. So it's all about premium subscriptions and how many premium subscribers are there out there. And that's the debate that I think every music conference, every panel, every article about digital music for the next few years, that's the question that people are going to be asking.
Yes, and how long can any of these streaming companies go along not making any money? Are we going to see some fall off the edge and go out of business? Will that be a benefit to the other companies? Say Tidal goes out of business, to pick one at random. Will its 3 million users move to Spotify or will they be lost? Will those people just go, oh, well, I tried streaming and then the company went out of business and so that was a waste of my time?
And I suppose in some ways that is one of the challenges at the moment. You've got quite a lot of players in the market, less than there were 18 months ago, but quite a lot of players in the market. And almost as an element of realistically, they're not all going to survive. And all, the two big ones are Spotify and Apple Music. Obviously, Amazon Prime pitching in a different market. What is the future for Deezer and Tidal and Napster Rhapsody and Guevara? And, you know, almost at some point, some of those will go. You're right. If the market can keep the subscribers and they all float over to another service, then the market actually will be stronger when some of those little ones disappear.
But I think
the market won't be as good because there'll be less choice.
But there will be a number of people who are like, well, I paid for that service. I spent ages making my playlists and doing all that. And what happens normally when these services go out of business is you lose everything.
Well, and except that, I think when audio went offline, I can't remember if that was ever official or whether it was some clever people doing unofficial how to export your playlists and import them into a Spotify account. And I suppose there could be the Spotify's and Apple Music who are likely to stay the distance. Perhaps they should be doing more of that when services go under.
I mean, this is a debate that's actually been happening since the beginning of streaming starting to grow. It's like, why can't I export my playlists and pump them in somewhere else? Who owns the playlists that you've created? And there should be a means to... Well, it might not even shut down. You might want to just move to a different service because you might think this service has something very slightly different that I would like.
Like a Kanye record.
Like a Kanye record. I would like to move over and I would like to take my playlist with me. And currently you can't do that.
There are normally little unofficial widgets elsewhere on the internet that you can do. But you're right, it isn't
There's no
usually.
Official way of doing
yeah.
that, though.
So perhaps there should be to allow that to happen. So where are we at? And then another conversation people have been having in the last couple of weeks. We expect the Spotify IPO next year with the standalone music services. So not where they're bundled into an Apple or a Google and they sort of operate in a slight area of mystery because we never actually see the accurate financials just for the standalone service. But with a Spotify, once the IPO, you have to assume what will happen, as did happen with Pandora once they IPO'd in the US. You've then got the scrutiny of the city or of Wall Street, who will then start to push to get into profit sooner. And that will involve two things. First of all, do you really need this many staff? So I think usually a couple of years after IPO, I think we can see some downsizing in the streaming music companies. But also they'll say, why are we paying all this money over to the music industry when we're losing all of this money? And people have been saying, surely once Spotify have IPO'd, at the moment they're getting to, well, they're aiming to keep 28, 29% of the revenue. They're not because of the minimum guarantees. But that's what they're aiming for. Won't Spotify suddenly turn around and say, right, we need to keep 40% of the money, 50% of the money, which might happen. Although I think the first thing that's going to happen before any of that, it's the minimum guarantees. You know, Spotify is going to say, OK, have 70% of our revenue. That's fine. But at the moment, you're having 87% of our revenue because of the minima, because we're giving you these guarantees. We're going to shut down the guarantees and just have a revenue share arrangement. And I think that will be the first challenge. You know, if the music industry was actually earning on rev share rather than minima, would it have been such a rosy 2015? And let's assume that by 2020, the established services will stop the minimum guarantees. What sort of money will we be seeing? I still think there's huge growth for the streaming market. I think it's relatively early days.
Yeah.
As you go into new markets, obviously you can't charge $10 a month. You're charging the economic equivalent to $10 a month. So the value of a user is lower in other markets. So we can't assume that as we grow, every user has the same value. I know there was a piece by Mark Mulligan, the digital consultant who writes a lot about digital music. And his thing has always been is that despite all of the artists and songwriters saying we're not being paid enough, $10 a month, £10 a month, €10 a month is too high. And one of his recent blog posts was saying, actually, when you take the discounts they give to mobile companies, the student discount, and the fact that in other territories, actually, it's a lower price. Actually, the average is way below $10, £10, €10. Why don't we just admit that and go enter the market with a price closer to the Netflix price point? Actually, Netflix just put their prices up, haven't they?
But yes.
Closer to sort of like £6, £7 a month rather than £10 a month. Perhaps then we'll unlock a whole load more users and overall, everything will be better. Certainly that mid-market isn't yet being serviced. But I think there are more premium subscribers. The question is, how many more?
Yeah.
How many do we need and are they out there? Let's say it's 250 million. Let's say overall, the premium services need 250 million premium subscribers, bearing in mind the value of those subscribers varies around the world. If it's 250 million and they currently have, I mean, what is it? Probably 70 million at the most paying users across the services at the moment worldwide. Could you get up to 250 million? And would everybody be happy? And that's the big unknown. There is some work to be done. Well, either we wait and see. Or yeah, there's some maths to be done to try and work that out. But that's the unknown. So streaming is booming. Woo. It's an insecure business model that may or may not work. Oh, that's a bit of a worry. But hey, in the short term, we can all buy shares in Guevara.
Tedious legal news now. After that long first section, let's ease off with some tedious legal news.
I dispute that this is tedious.
It's not that tedious, but it is a bit of a technicality.
It's a classic samples case.
It is, but it's not the end. I mean, this case has been going since 2000.
Well, not quite 2000, early 2000s. Is it 2000?
I think it is 2000.
Right, it's been going a long time anyway. So it's a classic samples case, which is you sample a bit of music, you don't get it cleared, but it's like 2 seconds of music. Is that copyright infringement or is it not copyright infringement? And what's always interesting about the samples disputes is they're copyright cases that put creators against creators, where one creator says, surely I should be allowed to use 1 second of your music without license. That's my creative right, my artistic right. And then the person over here is saying, no, that's copyright infringement. You should have come to me for permission and paid me some money. Usually these sample cases are hip-hop cases in the US, but this is a European case.
Yeah.
With good old Kraftwerk.
Yes. So it relates to a track by... Well, actually, I think the featured artist was Sabrina Settler, who released a track called Nur Mir in the 90s. It was written by Moses Pelham and Martin Haas. Yeah, it used a 2 second sample of Metal on Metal by Kraftwerk.
But on a loop.
On a loop, yes.
So they
yes,
got good
yes.
value out of that 2 second
they used
sample.
They used it a lot, but it was 2 seconds nonetheless. And this has been, as we said, it's been going through the courts for a long time, and the German courts struggle to agree on whether it's copyright infringement or not, which is why it's been going on so long, because every time a court rules that it is copyright infringement, it goes to appeal, and the next court rules that it's not. And it's got all the way up now to, well, in 2012, it got to the German Federal Court of Justice, which ruled that it was copyright infringement, but now it's got to the German Constitutional Court, which has said, nah, think it might actually come under artistic freedom and therefore isn't copyright infringement. And so the federal court now has to reconsider the case.
I should say, this isn't the end of the
exactly.
case.
Exactly. So
because the Constitutional Court isn't ruling on this. They're just saying, we think the original ruling may have been unconstitutional. So have another think, is what they're saying. So it's got to go back to court. So it's bounced around all of those different German courts. And as you say, in some hearings, Kraftwerk won. In other hearings, the producer guy who put the track together won. Everyone agrees that he took the sample and he didn't clear it.
Yes.
So that's not under debate. What is under debate is, should that constitute infringement?
Kraftwerk won in 2012, largely on a demonstration showing how easy it would have been for Moses Pelham to just make that, or something very similar to that sample himself.
And
that
so either
just banging a bit of metal and using a sampler, he could have made a 2 second loop of his very own and he would have owned it and that would have been fine.
And so the argument almost there was basically you were being lazy.
Yeah.
So it's not that the only way you could achieve your artistic vision was by sampling and therefore this is about your artistic creative right. You were just being lazy and therefore it should constitute infringement.
But then you could argue if it's that easy and it sounds the same.
What's the
Does
point?
It matter? Why don't we all just pretend he did it?
So, as you said, the Constitutional Court has said, oh no, there's an artistic right here. And it was one of those classic things where the judges were saying, if we rule with Kraftwerk, as the court in 2012 did, sets a dangerous precedent, is what they were saying.
Yes.
And that it could hinder a whole form of creativity if people aren't allowed to take these tiny little samples and then do something interesting with them. So the artistic freedom right is the notion on the table.
Yes, though the German trade body BVMI,
which
said,
is the, sort of the BPI of
yes,
Germany.
They said it also sets a dangerous precedent.
More dangerous precedents.
But on the other side, saying if artistic freedom outweighs copyright infringement, then that just, it's all going to fall apart and everyone will just be using everyone's music all over the place.
So as I say, these cases are interesting because it puts creators against creators.
Yeah.
And I remember, I've probably said this before on the podcast.
Yeah, you probably have.
I almost certainly have.
I mean, just repeat ourselves.
I'm going to say it again. But if I screw this up, then Matt can go back through the archives and reinsert it the last time I said it.
Yeah. I can see his face from it.
A few years ago, there's British Black Music Month, which actually is all about to happen this year. So it's a series of events that happen in London, and they normally have one session focused on copyright. And I spoke as part of the copyright panel a few years ago. It was at the University of Westminster. And it was when, it's quite a long time ago now, because it was when the Digital Economy Act was going through and file sharing was what everyone was talking about, and should we do free strikes or web blocking? That was the conversation. So I was there ready to talk about file sharing and new rules. And actually, there was quite a few people on the panel. Normally, back in the day when there were piracy panels, I was the person saying, stupid labels, they're taking this too far, bad PR. But on that panel, there was quite a few people who were of the sort of the more critical of copyright. It had a really interesting mix of people, not just music industry people. So I almost ended up being on the other side of the debate, sort of saying, oh, well, hang on a second, we need to do something about file sharing. But that's what I got prepared to talk about. But when we actually went into the audience, because there were lots of people from more of an urban music hip-hop background, all they wanted to talk about was sampling. And why can't I sample? Why is sampling covered by a blanket license? Why if I use, take someone like DJ Shadow, if I use 100 samples in my track, okay, perhaps I should clear that. Okay, perhaps I should pay some money to the people I'm sampling. But why can't I just do that through PRS and PPL? Why do I have to go and do 100 agreements? There should be a blanket for sampling was part of the debate. There was then a couple of old school songwriters in the room whose work had been sampled. And they were like, no, it's my song. You know, write your own bloody song. You know, why are you sampling my song? So I think it's fascinating when these debates happen. And I think actually you're seeing in Germany, as every time this debate comes back to court, which is every 2 or 3 years for the last 15 years, is there is a divide. And there are some people saying, no, it sets a dangerous precedent. It's just going to have a free-for-all online. But there are other people, more perhaps on the urban music side, who are like, yeah, we're sick to death with being told we can't use a two-second sample in our track. And there should be a bit of artistic freedom here. I can't quite believe this case. As we say, this isn't the end of this case.
No.
God knows how long it will now take for it to get back to, what was the court? The federal something, Court of Justice, who heard it in 2012. So at some point, surely they've got to draw a line on this. But what precedent will it set? It seems to be that people think, whichever way they rule, a dangerous precedent has been set. But
so that's the only thing anyone can agree on, is that it's dangerous.
So for the time being, I would suggest that it's still not wise to include an uncleared Kraftwerk sample in your track.
Yeah, don't do that.
However much you feel you're expressing your artistic freedom in doing so, I would wait to see what the final ruling is on this case. Okay, CMU approved time now. We're running a little bit behind on the podcast, but hey, bank holiday week.
Hey!
So there's only three things to approve this week, because there was no CMU approved on Monday.
But they're as good as four.
They're so good this week. They're as good as four, but you're not going to talk as long as if there were four.
Well, we'll see.
We'll see. The Arised was your first approved of the week.
The Arised. Arised is desire backwards.
It is.
That's a thing. They release their new album, Room 414, this week. And I featured a couple of tracks off it, Liar and Even If. If you go to the website, you can see a very good live version of Liar. It's very good.
Now, the point you're making about this is, given the people involved and the label releasing it, you'd probably think it was drum and bass.
Yeah, so well, they were formed by drum and bass producers Detail and Hidden Element with singer-songwriter Sonia Surikova. They're signed to Med School, which is an offshoot of Hospital Records, drum and bass label. Sounds a lot like it's a drum and bass thing, but it's not. It sort of leans more towards pop and rock. Hospital generally try to stick quite close to their genre boundaries, but they've allowed themselves a little bit of freedom on this one. I think it was a wise choice because they're a very good band. And go to the website and check out the live version of Liar.
Exercising their artistic freedom. The German Constitutional Court would approve.
Yeah.
I'm sore. But you approved as well. Xena Hell, is that how we're saying this?
Yeah, why not? She's got her debut single, Catacombs, coming out in June, on the 10th of June, in fact. It is produced by Blank Mass, a.k.a. Benjamin Power from Fuck Buttons. As a result, I don't know if it's necessarily his thing, but it's quite over the top. Well, almost over the top. It's very...
Give us the line. The line that you've used here, you don't do social media anymore. You don't know this.
I don't know what social media is.
Quite popular on Twitter, your description here. So let's focus in on your description.
Well, I don't remember what I actually said.
It's what you've...
Is it what I've written here?
It's what you've got written down
here.
So
it's almost completely over the top, but kept teetering on the edge, which makes it exciting.
Yes, or worse to that effect.
Yeah, yeah.
Is what people liked. So that is out on the 10th of June.
Yes, and you should check it out.
And the final approved of the week is Hilary Woods.
Hilary Woods, who has a single called Bathing Out, comes from her new EP, Heartbox. You might know Hilary Woods.
You probably don't know the name, but you'll know the band she was in.
She was in a band called JJ72.
I remember? Said that. Matt didn't remember JJ72. No. Perhaps he's not old enough. I don't know how old he is. JJ72s were quite big for a while, although you were saying the blurb said two platinum-selling
two
albums.
Two double-platinum-selling albums.
I remember the first album being quite big. He had quite a screechy voice. not Hilary Woods, the front man.
Yeah, we don't need to talk about him because he's not on this.
No. No screechy voices.
Her music now is very, very different to JJ72. It's more electronic. It's sort of, well, it was the press release with this, it was written on piano late at night, trying not to wake people up. So it's a bit calmer than JJ72. And it's well worth checking out, seeing what she's doing now.
And the EP is called
Heartbox.
Out on the 10th. Of June.
Yes.
So if you want to know more about this week's approved tracks / artists, or maybe even you want to listen to the tracks.
Which you might do. You should, because there are three tracks that are as good as four.
Complete music.
Really selling it there.
CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved. And while you're there, click on the playlist button.
Yeah.
And listen to approved tracks via your Spotify.
Yeah. Just time to run through a few of the stories we've not had time to talk about this week and don't have time to talk about now.
But we're going to talk about them anyway.
Let's do it anyway.
We're rebels.
DHP Family has bought two of those Mama venues.
So Mama used to have a big network of venues, a couple of big ones, but mainly sort of small size venues. Live Nation bought Mama last year, so got all the festivals, got the venues, kept the really big venues, made them part of the Academy Music Group, and has been quietly selling off all the small venues, mainly in London.
Yeah.
And so DHP Family, who have venues at various places around the UK, but their main venue in London to date has been Oslo in Hackney.
Yes.
And always confusing when you say you're going to a gig at Oslo. People think you mean you're going to Oslo.
I interviewed a Norwegian band who were playing Oslo once and they were very confused,
very confused
about where they were going.
By the fact that the venue is called Oslo. But now they have two more venues in London.
Yes, the Borderline and the Garage.
So they're going to refurb those venues.
And they suggest they're going to switch them to the model that Oslo runs on. But Oslo is sort of a daytime...
More of a community hub.
Yeah, pub with like nice food. And a venue upstairs. It'll be interesting to see how that works. The Garage doesn't really seem like a venue that would be suited to that, but we'll see. Next, members of Rage Against the Machine, Public Enemy and Cypress Hill have formed a supergroup.
Called Prophets of Rage.
That's all we need to say about that.
Yep.
The Glastonbury team are working on a new event that will launch 2018, 2019, probably 2019. That is the amazing amount of detail provided by Emily Eavis.
Yeah, so we sort of knew this already because she first mentioned it about a month ago.
But she's talked about it again in a new interview with The Guardian. And so gone into this year's event.
Gone into it into more detail, although more detail without much detail.
More detail, but somehow less detail.
So there's going to be a Glastonbury spin-off event at some point in the future, maybe.
But this is sort of... So Michael Eavis a while ago started talking about, like, oh, it's all... We're probably not going to be able to do Glastonbury on Worthy Farm after 2018. It's all going to move. It's not going to be there anymore.
But Emily's sort of saying,
and she said,
that's
no,
not true.
That's not true. We're staying on Worthy Farm forever and ever, but we are going to launch a new event, and we're working on it now, but...
We don't know where,
we're not going to
when,
tell you about it.
Or what it's called.
Elton John went to Russia... As you might remember, last year he agreed with Vladimir Putin that they would meet and discuss Russia's not entirely good record on gay rights and treatment of HIV and AIDS. And so Elton John went to Russia
but
to
didn't have the meeting.
And they didn't have the meeting because they are scheduling conflicts.
But he talked about it on stage.
Yes, he did. And he commended Vladimir Putin's wife, who has just set up some awareness scheme for HIV and AIDS.
And he said, next time I'm in Russia, next time... I'm going to sit down with Vladimir and we'll hammer everything out, is what he said.
So if you want to read more about all of those things, why not go to CompleteMusicUpdate.com/podcast and find the show notes for this show, and you'll find the links to those stories in there, and that'll be fun for you.
You'll be able to read up on all the things that we didn't have time to talk about, but we did talk about.
We did talk about
the non-one-liners on the CMU podcast.
Here's a thing that we are going to talk about, unlike those things that we did talk about but didn't talk about. This one we are going to talk about.
Let's talk about it.
And I'm glad that's clear now. Ellie Goulding has been criticised by some for talking about politics.
It's true.
Specifically Donald Trump, who she does not think is a very good person.
Generally, but specifically to be President of the United States of America.
Yes, and she's been tweeting about this since last year. And some people don't like that. She was interviewed backstage at Radio 1's Big Weekend by the Daily Star about this. And it came up because she tweeted about Donald Trump last week and someone replied, "Don't stick your nose into politics and make me not want to come to your concert in June," to which she replied, "Don't come, please." Which, fair enough. You wouldn't want people with differing opinions to you coming to your shows, which probably never happens otherwise. But she was basically saying, "I don't speak about issues that bother me all the time, but this one I feel is particularly important, and I'm going to talk about it. And why should I not be allowed to do that?"
And why not?
Yes.
Obviously, quite a lot of people have been talking about Donald Trump's bid for the American presidency. Obviously, lots of people have been talking about it, but lots of musicians have been talking about it in the last year or so, although usually only when their music has been used by Donald Trump at a rally, and that kickstarts a whole, "Oh, stop using my music," even though technically you're allowed to under a BMI ASCAP blanket license in the US, but I don't want to be associated with your politics. And then sometimes artists who criticise, well, any politician, but specifically Donald Trump using their music, just leave it at a "don't use my music." Others say, "Don't use my music, and I think you're a horrible, nasty person, and you shouldn't be president of America." But I suppose Ellie Goulding had been commenting on this without the "you're using my music without permission" bit to the story, which seemingly gives you permission to comment.
Yeah, in other cases, it's probably been US musicians who've like Killer Mike has been actively supporting Bernie Sanders, so that he's been speaking out against Trump, but more speaking for Bernie Sanders than that. And then, like Ray Stremmerd, they've got a track called "Up Like Trump." And I think it was at South by Southwest, they made a point of saying, in quite blunt terms, "We're not supporting Trump. Don't assume that that is what we're doing."
But I think it's interesting, and again, it's in the US. In the last year or so, we have seen more artists coming out on political standpoints, some of it with regards to the presidential election, which hasn't actually really started yet, but the incredibly long primary season.
So long away.
And particularly against some of the things Donald Trump has been saying. And of course, we've had the people speaking out about the mad laws in a couple of states around the toilet bill, whatever it's called. What's
the
it called?
The bathroom bill.
The bathroom bill.
But it would be the toilet bill in the UK if we were living in a country where that sort of thing would happen.
So the laws that have come in that said that transgender people have to use the toilet of the gender of their birth rather than the gender with which they now identify. And a number of artists have spoken out against that, whether or not that's by cancelling gigs in those states or saying we're not going to play in those states in the future, or going ahead with gigs but then making a statement before or during the show. So we've had artists commenting on those stories in the last year or so. We mentioned last week, of course, the Bebop Live Brexit event.
Yeah.
Actually, I think other than pulling out of that event, we've not seen musicians entering. I mean, obviously, if you follow Billy Bragg on Twitter, he's quite vocal. I mean, there are certain artists. I mean, you mentioned Killer Mike. I mean, he's always very outspoken on political issues.
Well,
very
so
eloquent,
is Billy Bragg.
As is Billy Bragg. So there are certain artists who often talk about politics and always do. But then there are other artists who don't normally get involved in these debates, but in certain scenarios do. But I suppose perhaps it was Ellie Goulding, as a British artist with a fan base in America, who didn't have the excuse of being able to say, "Stop using my music," because he's not using her music, but still entering that debate. But then why shouldn't she? And you as a fan have to decide, does the fact that you disagree with her politics mean you don't want to listen to her music anymore? If so, don't listen to the music.
Well, this is
or
all
just
been,
live with it.
This has all been on Twitter. A lot of people would say, oh, the great thing about social media is that you can get closer to your favourite artists. You don't have to go through their PR people. You don't have to hear the PR spin. You can get their real opinions straight from the horse's mouth. And then if you don't like the opinions that come out, you can't then go, please stop having opinions. I mean, why shouldn't people have opinions?
So either exercise your commercial right to boycott the person's music or just agree to disagree. Why don't we all agree to disagree?
It'd be a lot more fun.
It would be. Would it be more fun? It depends if you enjoy long
no,
running.
No, I might retract that previous statement.
Let's agree to disagree.
I disagree with that.
With that. Are we all agreeing that actually Donald Trump would be a brilliant president of the United States of America. Is that what we've just agreed to?
I don't know what we're agreeing or disagreeing
anymore. Ellie Goulding is wrong.
But I know I don't agree with it.
Ellie Goulding's fan, I'm not suggesting she only has one fan, but we've been talking about a specific fan.
Yes.
Ellie Goulding's fan is right. Donald Trump for president, and all you musicians, shut up with your moaning. That's what I wouldn't say.
Donald Trump for president, let's get out of Europe. Boris Johnson for prime minister, and Scotland out of the UK.
You said we weren't going to...
That's all the things I either agree or disagree with.
Those are all things that could happen. You said that we weren't going to talk anymore about Prophets of Rage, this supergroup. One of the reasons they were saying, the reason why this band has to come together and the reason why Rage Against the Machine, Public Enemy, Cypress Hill, at least some of those are known for being quite politicised artists in the past. And one of their statements was, now is the time for an angry, politically aware, vocal music group, basically implying all this mad stuff's happening in the world. And we should shout about it on stage. Or rap about it in a nice...
Yes. I mean, a lot of people have been chatting about it. I'm not sure what effect they're going to have, but it's nice that they're going to give it a go.
It's nice that they're going to get out on stage and rage a bit about stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Looking forward to all that rage.
But of course, if we're going to have freedom of speech, we have to hear opinions from both sides. I would like to know what Donald Trump thinks of Ellie Goulding. He could tweet us. That could be the thing.
He won't tweet us, but at some point he probably will tweet the world.
He probably will. But I mean, I normally throw out a question for listeners here, but this is just a question for Donald Trump this week. What's your opinion on Ellie Goulding?
Yep, Donald.
Let us know at CMU on Twitter.
Tell us what you think.
Also, Donald, while you're here, give us a review on iTunes. And that can be everyone else. Everyone else can do that too.
Ellie Goulding can do that.
Ellie Goulding can do
Ellie
that.
Ellie Goulding's angry can fan
that.
Can do that.
All of you listeners can do that.
Powers of Rage. Is
we
that what
can
called?
Do. No, we can't do that. Power Prophets of Rage.
Prophets of Rage.
They can do that. It's World Review the CMU Podcast on iTunes Week. Everyone do that. There's going to be a big awareness campaign for that.
I think you've built that up so much. It's going to be quite disappointing now when nobody reviews our podcast in the next 7 days. But I can live with that. Well, I don't look. I don't even know. Hey, we've been talking for a very long time here, so why don't you do that stuff where you say this was presented by Chris Cook and Andy Milton, produced by Matt Peaty, and for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Oh, that stuff? Yeah. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt. Chris Cook was somehow involved. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, you should definitely go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Oh, water, I forgot about that.
I've drunk nearly all my water.
I've completely forgotten to drink any of it.
That's why you've been screwing up.
I haven't been screwing up.